I'm here in Belturbet and I'm talking to George Morrissey.
Two glasses.
Yeah. And so George Morrissey is an interesting name. What is the origin? Where did you originally come from?
It would be more at home down your part of the country than, well, certainly down. But it came from Brewery in the County Limerick. Yeah. And my father, Martin Joseph Morrissey, he grew up in the Brewery area with his friend, school friend, neighbour, and later comrade in arms, one Eamon de Valera. They shared many a wet hedge together at night and many a cock of hay that they slept in. They said they slept, when they slept in the cock of hay, they didn't sleep, they didn't burrow into the underneath, that would leave too much trace to be seen, so they took the top off the cock of hay, got in under it and pulled it back down on top of themselves, you know, just in passing. Yeah.
Well, they were extraordinary times too.
They were indeed. So, but to answer your question, that's where the name, my branch of it originated, and my father brought that name here to Belturbet in 1934. He came here with the Board of Works he was in charge of a river drainage scheme here on the River Erne, literally in Belturbet. The Erne flows through the town, and that's where the drainage was being done at Kilconny Bridge and upstream for the purpose of alleviating flooding. It was for agricultural drainage purposes. That's
okay.
Why he came here.
And so how many of you in the family then? How many siblings?
There's three brothers. The eldest was PJ, and I'm in the middle, George, and my younger brother, Martin. And so there were just the three of us, yes.
So growing up in this wonderful town of Belturbet, what was it like?
Well, it was different for the three Morrissey boys. It was different in that our father was a young rebel who had served with Eamon de Valera and had laid his life on the line for the cause, as many others did. And then when he arrived in this town, this of course was a border town, we're only 2 or 3 miles from the border, no matter which way you go. And he arrived to work here, and he met my mother in this very, very Protestant town, not only Protestant town because of the plantation, but a very, very, originally a very, very English town, in that the founder of Belturbet, so Stephen Butler, who got the grant of land, etc. here, brought over 200 English, specifically English, tradesmen, artisans, to build the first houses in the town, which were built where we're sitting now, actually. So then my father, that's just to set the scene for the town and its religion and its politics, purely and 100% English Protestant. And the native Catholics were allowed into the town during the day to work or whatever and serve their masters, but they had to be outside the boundary of the town at night.
And your mother then?
This is it. My mother was of the Galbraith family. She had been born here in this town. The Galbraiths from Edinburgh and Glasgow in Scotland were one of the earliest settlers here. And my mother, Hester Galbraith, had been born where I'm living at this moment, at the bottom of Barrack Hill, Morrissey Park, Belturbet. So her parents were Protestant, and they were anti-Catholic and anti-nationalist. So into this mix came my father, and when they met up and tried to get together even to go for a walk, there was objections from the family and from the community, to say the least. At one stage, my mother was actually locked in her bedroom so that she wouldn't be allowed to meet up with my father. But eventually, one way and another, love won out, and they did marry and had the three sons. Growing up, we took some abuse on the account of what I've just described, and one of the favourite insults given to us by all sides was a term that the youngsters had learned from the cinema and the Western cowboy and Indian films, and that was half-breed. So that's how we were described here in Belturbet when we were growing up.
Half-breeds,
but we were hardy boys, and we could hold our corner and give as good as we got, you know.
I know. And of course, you were brought up in the church, in the Catholic.
Yes, because my mother was a Protestant, father a Catholic through. Then was that, yeah. The even though the lady did not convert to Catholicism, the children would still be brought up in the Catholic faith, and that was the agreement.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. We were brought up in the Catholic faith, and many years later, about 20, 30 years, 25 years after her marriage, Mammy did convert to Catholicism.
Yeah. So talk to me about now your life. As soon as you finished school, what did you go on to do?
I did a couple of years in a local shop here, name of Reburn's. It was a grocery and bar and farm supplies. Big business at the time, now defunct completely because of drink. But anyway, I served my time there, as they say, for a couple of years. And then I, 16, I went to England.
Okay.
I go ahead from there.
Well, I went to a friend in Birmingham first, and I was very lucky to have that friend from Montorbet who I'd grown up with and hunted and shooted and fished with. And we both started work in different places in the industries in Birmingham, Hockleybrook area, and we both then finished up on the night shift in Cadbury's, which was a wonderful job, and I still ask myself why the hell I ever left it. But it was a wonderful place, and there were wonderful people to work for. And I think I realised afterwards it was partly because they were Quakers, so they lived their religion, as you probably know. Anyway, we lived together in a small little flat. And luckily we had a good canteen at Cadbury's. We were illegal on the night shift, and we weren't old enough to legally work the night shift. So we were found out, and we could have had a job on the day shift. There was plenty of work about then everywhere. But we decided that we'd leave and that we'd go out and earn some of this big money that was available on the building sites. And boy, was that a change, but for the worst. And yeah, we did get good money, there's no question about that, but we put in the hours 7 days a week.
So Cadbury's were where now? Where were
it? Bourneville in Birmingham.
In Birmingham.
Yeah.
And then when you went on to the building sites, where were the building sites?
That was, we were on Coles Hill Power Station. In Coles Hill, outside Birmingham.
Okay, and that was in the 60s and 70s, was it? Or
mid-60s, yeah. Mm. Yeah, a bit more. And then Mervyn, my friend, came home. There was sickness on the farm here in Belturbet, so He came back home to run the farm for a few months, and in that time, I moved out of Birmingham and I went to London. Worked in Crickenwood there, the famous Crickenwood. Worked in the exhibition centre, which was in that area at the time. It's in Birmingham now. And then I left there and I came home for a while, and I started doing various things, from fishing for eels to ship out to Billingsgate, to running a taxi and as a cover for smuggling at night. So one way and another I was making a living, but then the eel fishing finished in a certain period, and the smuggling wasn't too bad, but I wanted to go back to England, and I went back to England, and I went back to Manchester again to another friend from Belturbet, and he got me fixed up with a bed in his digs, and from there I got myself jobs. And when you have someone to point you in the right direction as to at least which way to turn when you go out the door, pardon me, it helps a lot. So I finished up then on working on the Salford City transport buses, the double-decker buses. So I worked there for a long time. That was shift work as well. Days, nights, or at least part nights. And I was a conductor there for a long time. And then I decided I'd apply for training for to become a bus driver, and this I did, and I drove buses in Manchester and Salford. One overlapped the other, so we were servicing both cities at the same time. And it was a wonderful job and good money in comparison to what was available here at the time. Mm-hmm. Shift work though.
Now, you were over there when the troubles were going on here in the north. And tell me about your brother, because he was killed.
He was murdered.
He was murdered then. And tell me, how did that happen and why?
Well, that's the why, but I'll tell you how I find out about it. And this was a big bugbear with the family, two big bugbears, and apart from the killing itself. And if we can just go back to when I was working on the buses, I met my late wife Jean on the bus. She was my conductress, so we settled down in Salford working on the buses, and we started a family there. And we had three children, two girls and a boy. And yes, I reared them through the troubles. And yes, I did definitely keep very much as possible in touch with what was going on here. And a big help there was Radio Éireann. And of course, the Mammy sent the Anglo-Celt, the cabin paper, every week, which was eagerly looked forward to. And also there was the Irish Post published in England, as you know. So one way and another, and then of course when you meet Irish people, what else would you be talking about, you know? So yes, I kept very much in touch. And but what happened with my brother PJ was very, very barbaric, and to say the least. When it's described in detail, it's almost beyond belief. But I found out about it thanks to RTE Radio and the Gayborn Morning Programme. Gayborn used to be on, you're probably old enough to remember, the morning, a couple of hours. And I was on my way back in a Nartic lorry from Birmingham. I was based in Manchester, I stayed in Manchester. even when I started my own haulage business. And I was on my way back from having picked up a load of timber at Manchester Docks and delivered it to Birmingham. And I had a radio in my cab that could pick up Radio Erin, especially in the Cheshire area where I was at this stage, halfway on the journey back between Birmingham and Manchester. Three-lane motorway, and in both directions, teeming with traffic. And the Gayburn show, which was on when I switched on, I was listening to, was suddenly interrupted. And it was, I don't know what the exact wording was, but it was to bring an important news item. And the news item was delivered via an RTE representative in the Drogheda area who had arrived on the murder scene very, very shortly after it actually happened. And how it happened was that my brother PJ, he's called Pat in the Garda Síochána, Sergeant Pat Morrissey, had been giving evidence in the courthouse in RD, and he had finished work for the day actually, and but as you know, a guard's never off duty. And he simply walked outside the courthouse with the intention of going home to his wife and four children, two boys and a girl, for the evening and the night. Instead of which, two young Garda, whom he knew his area, pulled up beside him in their car, one of their cars, and their own private car, that is, and told PJ that there had been a robbery at the RD Labour Exchange, and at that time, and until many years later, the dole money and benefits were paid out in cash. So it transpired that these two INLA rejects from the IRA from Cross Madlin, which was of course just over the border, had concealed themselves overnight in the shrubbery outside the Labour Exchange, as it was called, until the following morning. And when they judged the opportunity to be right, they burst into the office and seized the money at gunpoint. They then jumped on a motorbike and took off, heading back for Cross Madlin, of course. And the two young guards knew this and they were heading after them. And having met PJ and told him, and PJ got in the car, and because he was sergeant in charge, he took over and directed the boys to follow the motorbike, or at least where they thought it had gone. And on the way before they came in contact with the bandits, they came across a private car in the ditch, which had obviously very recently happened, and there was a lady in the car and three or four youngsters, I think. There was certainly youngsters in it, because that lady had collected them from school. Transpired that the guys on the motorbike had crashed into the car, the side of the car, and the lady car driver had gone into the hedge, and thankfully nobody hurt. So PJ left one of the guards to take care of the accident and the victims, and he and the other guard, Flynn, followed where they now knew the motorbike was gone. So when they came to a big house, I think of the name, they knew that they were told that they had headed in, and PJ knew his territory very well, and this was one of these big houses with an entrance, an avenue at two ends, both ends, one in, one out sort of thing. Yeah. So PJ knew this very well, and he was an ex-army, as we all were, father and three sons and grandfather before us. But anyway, he directed the young guard to go to the other end. And sorry, no, that's wrong. He directed the guard, young guard, to go in the same end that the bandits had gone in. And he went in the car round to the other end, Ratbrisk House, it was called.
Okay.
He went right.
How close to the border was that?
Be only a matter of, I think, 3 or 4 miles, something okay. like that, you know. Not a lot along with it, anyway. And he went to the far end. And it transpired that when the bandits crashed into the side of the car, they hurt their legs, and they were injured anyway. And they could no longer ride the bike, although apparently the bike was still rideable. But they were injured, and that was why they had gone into Ratbrisk House.
I see.
Or at least into the entrance, the avenue. And this is really horrible, like, not only for PJ but and his family, but for the family that lived there. We met them later, lovely people, but it affected them, some of them, terribly. And the thing was, there was a 14-year-old lad, son of the house, in his bedroom, which looked out over the entrance.
Yeah.
So he had a...
full view.
A grandstand seat.
Yeah.
Which he could have been doing without, as it later transpired. But because of the mental effect it had on him, but totally understandably, because when PJ approached Ratbrisk House and the young guard was coming up behind these two, when PJ got within speaking distance of them, he called them. They were obviously armed. They were armed. They were still armed. He knew that, he could see that. And he called on them to surrender, that they were surrounded back and front and they weren't going anywhere, as particularly as they were injured. But in spite of that, one of them, the leader of the two-man gang, McHugh, he fired a shot at PJ, although he knew that PJ, being in uniform, would not be armed, because that's the way it was then. And PJ didn't have any arms. He fired one shot at PJ and he blew his hip off. He blew his right hip off. So PJ went down to the ground. And remember, this 14-year-old kid's watching all this. PJ naturally went to the ground, and McHugh walked up to him, laughing at him, trying to get up. And he just simply put the barrel of the gun to his forehead and blew his brains out the back of his head.
My goodness. And so did he walk away from it then? Or what happened?
No. There was no way they were going to get away anyway. Common sense, a smidgen of common sense would have clarified that. The Garda and the army were very quickly on the scene, and the helicopter came in, and the guard, the helicopter, and it was summer, it was June, 27th of June, 85. The crops were in full bloom, and there was a field of corn or oats, something. And the two boys went in there like two rats, you know. And the helicopter knew they were there, and they simply hovered over them, and it flattened all the corn, and there they were. They stayed like two rats in the stook, you know.
Who were they? Who were those two boys? Who were those two men?
Well, the leader was McHugh. His name was McHugh. He was an adopted son of a very decent family, apparently, in Crossbatlin. And the other guy was Conlon. But personally, I never gave much heed of anybody owning McHugh, because from what I know, this other guy, Conlon, or Conlon, his name was, he was simply dragged along.
Okay.
And didn't take any hand or part in assaulting PJ or anybody else.
I see.
So I was never bothered about him. But McHugh, yeah. So they were immediately captured.
Yeah. What did that do to you? You heard it for the first time on the radio, you say, when you were listening to Gay Byrne's show.
Yeah.
And you were in...
I was in the cab of a lorry on the M6.
And the M6 in England?
Driving the lorry, yeah.
What was going through your mind?
How the hell am I... The hair went up on the back of my neck, and... well, there were six lanes of traffic altogether, you know, three in each direction.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, Jesus, if I let this thing go,
yeah,
there'd be a lot more than PJ did, you know.
Yeah.
You see, the thing was, when I heard it, I have to go back to the Gay Byrne show that had been interrupted. And it shouldn't have been, and we got an apology, written apology from RTE for that. But the interruption was that this local reporter for RTE had contacted the 14-year-old lad who had witnessed the whole thing. And he had got an interview from him. And I heard the young lad telling the story, and when the young lad, there's no way that interview should have been live over any radio, as they say, until all parties are informed, and it should never have been broadcast in the way that it was. No fault to the young lad. The local reporter didn't know. He never dreamt that he'd been patched straight through. These things, as you well know, we edited and edited and edited and all sorts of...
Of course,
you know,
yeah.
And there were no precautions taken at all, and yet it was a murder of a sergeant.
And this was... It's kind of hard to understand, you know, that was the first way you heard it.
Yes.
How did your parents hear it then?
Well, my father was dead at this stage. But it's interesting about how my mother heard it, because my mother was living alone in the house that I live in now. And she, of course, like every woman in the country, was listening to Gay Byrne. And when she heard the young lad giving his interview, she knew, as I knew, that it was PJ that was dead. Because the young lad said over the radio, no fault to him or the reporter, but he said, and Sergeant Morrissey fell down. There was only one Morrissey it could have been.
Yeah.
Sergeant, you know.
Yeah.
So he obviously knew PJ, you know. And Mammy heard that, to answer your question.
Yeah.
That's exactly how Mammy heard it. Patched into the Gay Byrne show.
Now, here's an extraordinary story. It is, because you grew up in a very Republican background. Your father, as you say, was...
No, it wasn't a Republican background.
Yeah, well, from Brewery, and, you know, your father...
Yeah, but then my mother was the other side of the house.
She was the other side of the house as well, yeah. But at the same time, how do they feel then about the IRA and the perpetrators, the people who carried out this.
How did you feel?
How did your mother and your family, your brother, your other brother feel? And
as a family unit,
were you blaming
it? An extended unit. We always blamed the IRA. It was technically there were the INLA, but as you probably know, there were rejects from the IRA who had armed them and trained them.
Yeah.
So to us, it's the same stable, you know.
It's the very same, yes. And so that, you know, that kind of fight for freedom or fight for, it was a different war.
No, this was just money. They wanted to bring back a pile of money so that they'd be the heroes, either of the, maybe get them back into the IRA.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Yeah. Did you come home after that?
Oh, yes. So I came home. I came home with the family that night. The ferries were all booked up, but they made room for us in the circumstance. Hmm. And I always appreciated that.
Yeah. I sense, George, that even now talking to you, you find it hard to talk about this.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I do, I'm quite sure that I know part of that reason that would be there anyway, but it would always be there. As Bernie Page's widow said at the time on radio, that she said, we'll take it to our graves.
Yeah.
And we will, but you see, this is jumping ahead now.
No,
but
go ahead.
When we went back to England, see, I had no one to talk to about it. I wasn't going to be talking to my wife about it all the time. She had enough of it herself. And there was nobody else that would care or know.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but it was, it's just, if I can get back to my mother, she was sitting alone in the house, and the neighbors, the women, had also been listening and knew, and they sort of gathered outside their own house and then went down to Mammy's, and they didn't know what to do for the best, because if they went in, Mammy would know there was something wrong, drastically wrong, and if they didn't go in, she'd be on her own.
Yeah.
So what would they do?
It's terrible.
Yeah. So that was it, yeah. So anyway, they did eventually go in, and Mammy did know. And she had been living with that for at least half an hour, maybe more, three quarters of an hour before a Garda representative arrived to officially tell her.
Yeah.
So, and they took their time getting there. Yeah. But of course, it was such an upset for everybody, and there was some understanding to be made, or some allowance to be made, you know. But RTE, I dealt with RTE later, and many years later they made a film about it, and not a film, a
documentary
is the word, and they asked our opinion of the family, etc., etc. So Martin, my younger brother, and I gave them an interview, and in it, this hurt us all. The Marty, we had a good idea of what we were both going to say. There was no point in duplicating things. So Marty took up the issue on the interview with the fact that this killer, McHugh, was known as Billy the Kid in Crossmaglen and the area. He had already caused the woman's death via an accident with a motorbike. He was forever in trouble. And he had a charge sheet as long as your arm. And a few days or shortly before he killed PJ, he was on the run for something from the Garda, and he he stole a small fire engine in some village up in Meath. And he, it was, I think it was a Land Rover converted. And he buried that in a Garda, rural Garda station. And when he was being taken away, arrested for that, he said, "I'm going to kill one of you fuckers." And he did. It was Petey. And that's the photo you see if you look in the archives and newspapers. That's the photo that most of them use. It's a photo of him looking wild and his hands up, and he's saying, "I'm going to kill one of you fuckers." He did. And the family interview with RTE many years, I don't know exactly how many years after the murder. We all gave our opinions on the happenings during and after. And Marty specifically brought up the point of, as I'd already explained, that the killer of PJ had a very, very long charge sheet and had threatened to kill a guard on him. He was just one troublemaker. Even the IRA had rejected him because, believe it or not, he was getting them a bad name. But Marty made the point on the interview with RTE on the documentary that how come this guy had committed so much crime in the County Louth, and in fact, on, of course, on both sides of the border, but let's stay in the Republic, and how come he was actually had been arrested several times and had this ferocious charge sheet, and yet he seemed to have had complete freedom to roam wherever the hell he wanted on both sides of the border and commit crime, serious crime. How come he was out of jail so that he could carry out his threat to kill a guard, i.e. PJ, my brother? Marty asked that question on the documentary. But Marty's interview was the only one of the family interviews relating to this subject that was not broadcast on RTE television.
They edited that out?
They edited that out. And we could never get a satisfactory answer for that. And we really couldn't figure out what it could have been.
It's extraordinary, and that's the way the media works. And, you know, they can...
It's subjective.
So people believe exactly what it is that's being said then.
Yeah, yeah.
It's frightening, isn't it?
It is, really, when they can be controlled like that without anybody even threatening them or anything.
Yeah.
It's there, and they know damn well it's there, that they'll suffer.
Yeah.
If they do, in this instance, it's Marty's interview.
It's extraordinary, yeah. Is there anything else you want to say?
Yes, Mummy.
Yeah, go on.
You
go
see, RTE and the interruption of the Gay Byrne show on radio and the patching in, unknown to him, of the local correspondent literally on the murder scene, and his interview with the 14-year-old kid who had witnessed it. Who was responsible for that? There was nobody. That should obviously never have happened. And yet, we never got, we did get an apology, but we never got an explanation of how it happened. But I'm glad to say, so far as I know, it hasn't happened since.
Yeah.
There was a lesson learned there, but it was a hard lesson for us, and particularly Mummy.
Of course.
And it could have caused that. It could have caused a multiple pile-up on the M6 in Knutsford service station in England.
Yeah. How you held
your nerve and your head.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in the middle of all that.
Yeah.
Gee,
yeah.
Do you know, George, it's incredible. I did the aftermath in the years that followed, and that marvelous monument that I went and looked at today, and it's lovely to see that in place now. And I see it as a reminder of the troubles.
Yes, well, I see it as a great tribute to the family, because the monument itself came second. The park, naming of the park came first. Where you see the park now and the children's play area down along the River Erne, that was once the site of a very, very large British military barracks.
Yes.
Dating back to the 1700s, it was originally a cavalry barracks. But anyway, it was still functioning in 1922 when the IRA took it over. But then later on, it was demolished and turned into a public park, and didn't actually have a name. And the local priest at the time, when PJ was murdered, he suggested that because the Morrisseys had all been born and reared and in the area of the park. The houses we live in are just outside what was the military barracks, and there were officers' houses, five little thatched houses. And that was put to the local people in a private site, and the local people overwhelmingly decided to call the park after PJ, Morrissey Park. That's why it's now called Morrissey Park.
Yes.
And then later on, the people again built that monument. That's purely local raised funds and will of the local people that put that there. And I have always said to people who... Some people have said to me that Belturbet would have been a border town, would be an IRA town. Well, I said, go and look at Peter's memorial. It doesn't look that way to me, you know.
No, it doesn't.
So that's how that came about.
George Morrissey, thank you so much. I'm delighted that we finally met and we spoke. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. I'd like to mention that PJ was the founder member of the Garda Síochána Sub Aqua Club, and for many years he actually did diving for the Garda Síochána with bits and pieces that he had gathered up here and there, and he was operating in a very dangerous environment, including one time in the Killybegs Harbour in the Atlantic, where a fishing vessel had sunk overnight with four fishermen in the vessel, and the Democrat, the Donegal Democrat, reported that Garda Morrissey had dived beyond human endurance, and his purpose in doing that was, risking his own life, was to try and recover the bodies for the family, so that they would have a place to go to, a place to remember their dead.
And that was, did you mention Lord Mountbatten?
Yes, it was later on. Visiting Mammy in Barrack Hill, and he had an old Morris car, and a guard arrived from the barracks at the time and told him he was wanted on the phone in the station, rather, and he went up, and some superior officer was there, and told him that Lord Mountbatten's boat had been blown up in the harbour over in Sligo on the Atlantic, and that with Lord Mountbatten, his 14-year-old nephew, a 17-year-old friend from Enniskillen, and the Lady Dowager were on board. That's all they knew. and he was ordering PJ to get over there as fast as possible. And PJ at last knew he had him where he wanted him as regards funding, because they say they hadn't given him anything. And PJ said, well, I hope you now realise that how important the subaqua thing would be, and et cetera, et cetera. And I am not going down into the depths of the Atlantic with the equipment that I have, because I'm again risking my own life. And what about my wife and family, you know? And anyway, deal was done, and he did the dive for Mountbatten's body and the young lad, and the lady Dowager died the next day. I don't know how she escaped. I could never work that one out, but certainly Mountbatten, the young lad, and his friend were dead. Yeah,
and it was PJ that it.
PJ did that, yeah.
That actually dived brought the bodies in.
He may have received help before the job was done. I don't know that.
Yeah.
But I know he went over there straight away. There couldn't have been anybody there before he was there. You know?
Imagine, yeah.
Because he always had the bit of gear he had. He always carried it with him.